Hello, I'm Jane Crowther. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film. This is the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine, and today I've got our news editor, Jordan Farley, with me. Hello, Jordan.
Hello.
And our deputy editor, Matt Matem. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
This week we'll be talking with Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx and Brie Larson about Just Mercy, as well as praising Amazon Prime's new show, Little Fires Everywhere, comedy caper The Lovebirds, and Greta Gerwig's Little Women. Plus, we'll be testing your movie knowledge with another quiz. But first, should we talk about the wealth of vintage movies that are hitting BBC iPlayer? There's 23 RKO pitch classics coming to the platform. That's a whopping amount. Have you had a look at what's coming? What do you fancy on that list, Jordan?
Yeah, it's an incredible selection. Some absolutely stone-cold classic, iconic films. Citizen Kane, King Kong, if you've never seen those two, make them your first stop. And there's quite a few that, you know, I either haven't seen for a number of years or I haven't seen at all. So I'm actually quite looking forward to delving into this and checking out some, you know, some oversights from my film viewing history, like The Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles film, which I've never actually seen. So I'm looking forward to catching up on that.
Yeah, what about you, Matt? I mean, there's Angel Face, there's Bringing Up Baby, another classic. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, if you've never seen that, that's a cracker. What are you going to pick out?
Yeah, there's some great ones. Yeah, and as Jordan was saying, it's a great time now to kind of mop up any that you might have missed. But Suspicion is one I would kind of highlight, the 1941 Alfred Hitchcock film. It's perhaps not quite as well known as some of his kind of copper bottom classics like Vertigo and Rear Window and Psycho and all those. But if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. And there's a bit of a sort of tacked on happy ending, which is maybe a bit of a letdown, but up until then it's very tense sort of psychological thriller, and it's fun to see Cary Grant play against type as well. Mm-hmm. And you also get Joan Fontaine in this film, who, for a bit of trivia, is the only actor to win an Oscar for a Hitchcock film. So
And speaking of Oscars, we've had some news this week that the Oscars is possibly going to be delayed early next year. What do you think that does to the season? I mean, is that going to throw everything in disarray, or is it a good thing because it gives more films more chance to be actually in the running?
I don't know if this affects film release schedules more than they're just thinking, is there going to be enough out for us to be able to properly have a competition by February next year? You know, there's no
Sonic obviously. The Hedgehog wins everything.
Yeah. Well, Jim Carrey was great in that film. I think he deserves best actor.
There you go.
I doubt the Academy will think the same. You know, Cannes obviously not happening this year. Venice, TIFF, they're sort of still up in the air. It could be we get to the end of the year and you don't have any of the usual kind of raft of awardsy films that usually end up sweeping the nominations come January. So I think this is more of a contingency for the fact that there might just not be enough films out for them to even have a proper Oscars ceremony.
Yeah, it would just be kids' films, just like Trolls and various other things.
They might finally acknowledge a horror performance in that Elizabeth Moss could win Best Actress for The Invisible Man. That would be great. But apart from that, I think it would be a bit of a hollow ceremony if there weren't enough films.
I mean, there's also the safeguarding aspect of this. There's sort of the conspiracy theory going around that COVID actually started at the Oscars last year and Tom Hanks had a bit of a cough then. You know, it could be that they just can't have that many people crammed into the Kodak Theatre, even in February.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope that far away that we wouldn't be worried about packing people into a room by then. But, you know, it could still be an ongoing concern. So this could go on a lot longer than anyone's thinking.
Yeah, we could have the Zoom Oscars.
It's very disheartening for me to think that even by sort of autumn, winter, the traditional awards season, and when those films typically get released, that we still might be having cinemas open. I mean, that's what this is kind of suggesting, really.
They've already said that they're going to consider films that were supposed to release in cinemas but have been forced to go onto streaming. So films like Trolls World Tour could be up for Best Animation. But, you know, even then, I don't think there's anything out except maybe Never Rarely Sometimes Always, which we discussed last week, which is a fantastic film. There's not much that's even come out this year where I would go, that deserves to win Best Picture or that deserves to win this category. It just feels like there's just not enough films out there to properly judge them.
Do we just have a bumper double Oscars the year after then?
Yeah, even longer, a 10-hour ceremony. Who knows?
It's already long enough as it is.
Yeah, we'll see. Okay, shall we move on then and have a look at something that missed out last year from the Oscars, even though it had Oscar buzz when it premiered in TIFF. Let's have a look at this real-life tale.
The first time I visited Death Row, I wasn't expecting to meet somebody the same age as me. From a neighborhood just like ours. Could have been me, Mama.
But what you're doing is gonna make a lot of people upset.
You always taught me to fight for the people who need the help most. Your life is still meaningful, and I'm gonna do everything possible to keep them from taking it.
You only know what you're into down here in Alabama when you're guilty from the moment you're born.
God.
Mr. McMillan.
We done here. Mr. McMillan, please.
Okay, so that's Just Mercy, which is the true story of an idealistic young defense lawyer, Brian Stevenson, who sets himself up in Alabama in the late 80s to represent death row prisoners. One of the inmates he meets is Johnny D, a man who's been found guilty of murder despite very shaky evidence against him. And Brian Stevenson is now a world-renowned civil rights lawyer and the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, and he's played here by Michael B. Jordan, with Jamie Foxx playing Johnny D and Brie Larson as Stevenson's office manager. Obviously, it premiered in TIFF. Matt and I saw it there. But before we chat about it, let's hear what Jordan, Foxx, Larson, and the director, Destin Daniel Cretton, had to say about it when our Hollywood correspondent, Adam Tanswell, sat down with them. He started by asking them why a story set in 1989 was still relevant today.
Just Mercy is one of the most relevant books that I have read in a long time. That it is a story that takes place in the late 80s, early 90s, but everything in this book is still happening today, and the story is so universal. It does take place in the South, but the themes and the characters and the idea of just a power structure and the people in power who have found a way to stay in power by keeping the people below down is something that can be translated anywhere, and I think it's really exciting to put this movie into the world and see how people respond to it.
Well, I feel like you kind of nailed it, but I wish that the story was told sooner. I'm grateful that it's being told now because it's an incredible group of people that got to make it, but it's so vital that we have these conversations sooner rather than later. This is a story about a system, but it's also about the people that make up that system, and we as people need to have conversations about that and how we can fix it, starting with ourselves.
So I feel like it's the same story that's been happening, you know, 30, 40 years ago. You know, this movie takes place in 87 through 89, and it's 2019, and it's still relevant to today. We need to look at ourselves, look at our systems, and really start to demand answers. You know, not being content with the way things have been. We really have to force change and force the issue. And sometimes you have to, you know, hide the medicine in the food. You know, you have to put out a piece of art to get people to sit down and actually take and listen, you know, and really feel something. And hopefully over time, you know, that might be able to change the habit of thought.
And to piggyback on that, I think that in Michael B. Jordan's career, and I say this to him all the time, and I will probably repeat this forever and ever, when he did Fruitvale Station and he took our breath away in that movie, and then you see what he did with a big budget movie, Killmonger, when he's in Black Panther, who he's amazing. But he still had the narrative of caring about justice, caring about us, caring about the community. Mm-hmm. And that's a big thing when you see someone who rises to the level he rises, but is able to come back and do a movie that is so important. And I don't know if he knows how important this is, but I'll just do this. 1 million views on my Instagram. I'm not even an Instagram dude. But 1 million views on my Instagram for the trailer and every single comment from Black, from white, from Asian, from people all over the world who are like, we need this. And it's true in the trailer, it says, this is about all of us.
It is.
It's just a wonderful time to have this movie come out.
And how would Destin and Brie change the system if they could?
Good question. I feel like we're not the experts on that. That's a question that you should ask Brian about. And it's something that we've talked with him at length about. I think the beginning of it, though, starts with empathy. I think what this film is talking about is just about having compassion and empathy for others. That would be the beginning.
One of the most powerful ideas in Brian's book is that you cannot understand a problem unless you allow yourself to get very close to the people who are affected by that problem. And I think as long as we see the judicial system and the problems as just pure statistics and information, it is something very easy to put in the back of our minds. But I hope that this movie allows you to get to know the people and what this system is actually doing to real people that you can relate to that are not so different from you, and allows you to get closer in the same way that Brian hopes that we will. And I hope that proximity will allow you to see this as a problem that all of us should be involved with.
And finally, can movies really change the way we see the world?
Absolutely. Being able to expose people in a way that allows you to have time with the subject, and more importantly, to have time with the people behind the subject, that's so valuable. It's so valuable.
I think we all got into this business because movies have changed our own lives. I can count back to so many movies that gave me a new perspective on life or a new perspective on a subculture or a character or a person that I once maybe viewed as a stereotype. And I hope this movie can do that for anybody out there, whether they fully relate to the exact scenarios that these characters are going through. I hope it allows those people to feel less alone in the world. But I also hope that the movie just shows people we are very much the same. We all love, we all laugh, we all go through shit and really push to get to the other side. And to me, that's the power of film, is reminding us that we're all in this together.
So that's what Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx and Brie Larson and Destin Daniel Cretton think about the film. What did you guys think about the film? Obviously, just tell us a little bit more about the case that Stevenson is actually appealing in this particular film, Jordan.
So yeah, Brian Stevenson, he's this idealistic young lawyer who's just sort of graduated. And instead of taking up, you know, a high-flying, high-paying job in the city, he decides to go to Alabama and basically defend death row inmates. So one of the first cases that he takes up is John Dee, Jamie Foxx's character. He wants to appeal the fact that he's been convicted and sentenced to death. And John Dee, he's basically resigned to the fact, he pleads his innocence, but he doesn't believe that justice can be served where he is. He has no trust or belief that Brian can actually overturn his conviction. And the film's sort of about their sort of growing bond and Brian's fight against a clearly biased and unjust system that's going on down there in Alabama, you know, racially biased, biased against inequality. The police, they're all in on it. They're all corrupt. The judge, there's the whole judicial system is geared towards convicting and getting the correct figures rather than, you know, finding out the truth.
So did it move you? Did it do what the filmmakers wanted it to do? Did it make you think about the situation and the fact that it is still relevant today?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt this is a story that deserved to be told, that needed to be told. There's some really powerful stuff in here. You know, Michael B. Jordan and especially Jamie Foxx, they're both really superb. Fox really sort of transforms for the part, and you can really see that he's put in the legwork in terms of portraying a very different character. There's a really moving sequence sort of in the middle of the film where, you know, a death row inmate called Herb, played by Rob Morgan, he takes the long walk. And it's just one of the most upsetting things I've seen on screen this year. It's really quite affecting.
I agree. That scene, you know, you really do need your tissues with you for this film when that scene happens. The last film that I remember making me feel like that was Dead Man Walking. Just the inhumanity of putting someone to death, especially with his case, is quite similar, in as much as he probably shouldn't be in that place, like many of the other people that are on death row for various reasons. He has post-traumatic stress disorder and may have acted in a way that was not natural to his normal demeanor. So it really makes you question a lot of things. It was overlooked by all the awards bodies. Why do you think that is, Matt?
I think possibly it's because it is very formulaic. I actually enjoyed it a lot and I thought it really worked in terms of what it was trying to do. And it, as you guys have said, it tells a very sort of important story in a very impactful way. But yeah, it does very much stick to a formula you recognise. It doesn't really show you anything you haven't particularly seen before. And I thought it was quite long for a film that's ultimately on a fairly predictable path, even if you don't know the story. It's just because of the fact they're telling this story, it's fairly obvious where it's going to go.
Yeah.
And I thought, as Jordan mentioned, Jamie Foxx was outstanding. I thought he was the one who should have been noticed in award season. I think, like, I'm surprised he didn't get any supporting actor nods, his best role in just years. But there's a lot of quite sort of wiggy acting in it, I thought. A lot of those kind of, you know, where, with the accents and everyone's either got a wig or some ostentatious glasses. I found that just slightly distracting. But still, despite those kind of you know, reservations. I still enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I don't think this is Brie Larson's finest hour, for example. She appears to be acting entirely through the wig, just doing a favor for Daniel Destin-Cretton, I guess.
But, yeah, because they work together on Short Term 12, so they sort of have that history. Yeah, she feels a little bit distracting in it, I have to say, because you're like, oh, look, there's Captain Marvel, like, filing in the background with a perm wig happening. I actually thought Michael B. Jordan was actually really good in this as well, because I've sort of only seen him as Killmonger or Creed, sort of very physical acting. And in this, he does a lot of very quiet acting, and none more so than in the particular scene where he first goes to the prison and he gets strip searched by a guard, and that's just what happens. Mm. That's, you know, that sort of racial profiling is just what happens, and what happens on his face, his emotions are just all on his face. It's really a great bit of acting. And he also produced the film, so I feel like both of you guys, I was moved by it, but I also felt that it had great intentions but wasn't really quite there in order to get gold.
Yeah, a cynical person could say, speaking of the Oscars, that it felt like they're trying to tick the Academy's boxes to try and get awards recognition. But I have no doubt that, you know, Michael B. Jordan and Daniel Cretton wanted to tell this story and thought it was important to tell. But I feel like somewhere someone was telling them to do it a certain way.
But in terms of relevance, probably still is just as relevant now as it was in 1989. We've obviously got issues even happening with lockdown, with racial incidents happening. So it does feel like it's a film that you could still enjoy and not feel like it's just a history note.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's a very easy film to watch. It's very well made in that respect. Even though it's long, it sort of ticks along. And just because you're learning all these kind of shocking aspects of the case, there's just something inherently sort of kind of gripping, and you're obviously outraged at the same time. And yeah, so it's a very, very easy film to watch. I think a lot of people would get a lot out of it.
Okay, so we are recommending that, with the caveat that if you are offended by real Southern accents, wigs and glasses, it might not be for you. Okay, so it's Just Mercy, which is available on digital now, but it's out on DVD on the 25th of May. All right, let's move on then to Amazon Prime's new must-see TV show, which is this.
We all have parts that scare us.
Did you really think I wasn't going to find out?
Parts that we run from.
You haven't been honest with me about anything! It's not.
Parts that we're afraid to look at.
You are coming completely unraveled.
I am completely raveled.
Everybody's going to be held accountable for their actions.
I know about your little secret. Are you threatening me?
So this is Little Fires Everywhere, which is produced by Reese Witherspoon. Set it up for us, Matt. What is this about?
Probably should start firstly by saying it's exec produced and key episodes are directed by Lynn Shelton, who sadly died last week. And she wasn't kind of necessarily a household name in the UK, but she's best known for kind of mumblecore movies like Hump Day, Your Sister's Sister, Outside In. And she's directed a lot of episodes of great TV shows like Mad Men, Glow, New Girl, and lots of others. And she directs the first episode of this and other key episodes. And it's adapted from a book by Celeste Ng, and it's produced by Reese Witherspoon, who kind of often seems to like finding books to kind of adapt for herself into TV shows. And yeah, so Reese Witherspoon is Elena, who she's this part-time journalist and a sort of local busybody who crosses paths with Kerry Washington's Mia, who's an artist who's new to this Ohio town. And she's seemingly there for a short stay, and Reese Witherspoon basically rents a house to her, and their families kind of cross paths. And you sort of half expect it to be called Big Little Fires Everywhere, because have a lot in common with Big Little Lies. I've actually only watched one episode so far. I know you guys have watched three, and I didn't warm to it as immediately as I did to Big Little Lies, but I was intrigued by the first episode, so I will be carrying on. But what did you guys think?
I totally agree with you that it really is very reminiscent of Big Little Lies. Reese is playing a very similar character, this sort of queen bee, very controlling woman. But there seems to be more humour in this, certainly at the first episode, sort of taking the mick out of this character, that she only ever drinks 4 ounces of wine and no more, and that she schedules her sex with her husband on a Wednesday and a Saturday. And if it's gone past midnight on Wednesday, then it's Thursday. So no, you're not having any. It sort of sets her up as this sort of quite comedic character. Although these two women are butting heads, it's a lot about not just them, it's about the children of these families as well. And it feels very, again, like Big Little Lies, very much about women's experience of the world and motherhood and how that looks to different people and what that means to different people. So I thought it was something that would really appeal to a lot of people and would be interesting to a lot of people. And I actually was really quite hooked. I want to know what's going to happen next. What about you, Jordan?
I definitely want to keep going. I haven't read the book, but this actually reminded me of Parasite a tiny bit in the way that it's kind of about two families from two very different kind of socioeconomic backgrounds, and the kind of less well-off family have kind of ingratiated themselves into the lives of this wealthier family. Mia, the mother, sort of starts working for Elena as house manager, she says, because she doesn't want to put a foot in it and call her a maid or whatever. The daughter kind of becomes friends with the kids, and you know, Elena's family, they're incredibly wealthy. I don't know, quite know how they're that wealthy, given Elena's a journalist. And
isn't dad a lawyer? I think that's maybe where the money's coming from.
But the house, which you see kind of burned down at the beginning of the first episode, and which kind of sets up the mystery of this season, I suppose, is just absolutely enormous. It's like this ridiculous mansion.
It's an absurd house.
Yeah, it is.
We should also say that it's set in the 90s, and I'm not entirely sure why it's set in the 90s at the moment, other than to add a bit of nostalgia when you get to hear like Chumbawamba at the local homecoming dance.
And when you see car phones in use.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like an odd choice at the moment, but I'm sure it's going to have a purpose later in the season. But I am enjoying it, and I'm sort of more or less hooked, but at times it can almost feel like a parody of like the peak TV era we're living in now. Like when the title sequence started, I almost started laughing just because it felt like every TV show you watch nowadays has a title sequence like this.
Yeah, where
you
it's get like the night manager, and it's that specific type of title sequence.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Like I couldn't help but think there's a show on Netflix called American Vandal, which is like a spoof of true crime shows like Making a Murderer. And all I could think was, if you change like one or two things in Little Fires Everywhere, you could just make it into a hilarious spoof of like a peak TV show. But they're just taking it deadly seriously, and it's not meant to be a spoof at all. But I do like the characters, and I think it's taken it into some interesting directions, so I will persevere with it.
One of the things I want to see more of is Kerry Washington's character Mia, because she's so rude. She really is eye-rolling to Elena's face generally whenever she's talking to her, and clearly disgusted by her, and yet doesn't ever get called on it. And I feel like that's really interesting to see someone that's really quite unsympathetic and doesn't pretend and doesn't play any social games. And how is she getting away with that? And the fact that that obviously intrigues Elena, because she can't really believe that she's so rude to her face as well. And where's that going to end up? So that's the thing that's intriguing me at the moment. I think it's really interesting to see a woman that is unapologetic like that within this sort of very domestic drama.
From the first episode, I did really like the kind of unsettling atmosphere it sort of has, despite being a kind of a comedy. There is this weird sort of darkness to it, and there's almost this sort of Stepford quality to the town where the grass has to be cut to strict standards, and it's all about the kind of facades and appearances and picket fences and everything. I liked that kind of almost underlying darkness to it. So that was something which kind of made me think, yeah, I'll kind of stick with this.
Again, it's just very reminiscent of Big Little Lies, isn't it? Where it's this just insulated community where people do things the way they do things, and then you have this outsider coming in who kind of gets welcomed in. Yeah, it does feel like they very much went, this worked great here, let's try and replicate it a little bit over here, and emphasize the things that people seem to like, which you can't blame them, because it worked wonders for HBO, so I'm sure it'll...
Reese clearly knows what works for her with these kind of type A sort of characters that she's been playing since like Election, really.
So I have read the book, and I do think it is quite interesting what they've done with casting here, in as much as in the book, Kerry Washington's character is white. And so that makes it a very white drama, and casting her in this adds a different dimension and does add that sort of political aspect to it that's really interesting and makes it, what Mia does as a character, as an artist and everything, is completely different and a little bit more interesting, I think. And also it just makes it far more interesting to watch, doesn't it?
Yeah,
that surprises me actually, because to me, yeah, that was one of the kind of the most intriguing things about it, that just as kind of Jordan said, that socio-economic difference between them, that it is just kind of exacerbated by race as well. And yeah, so I'm sort of surprised that that wasn't actually part of the original book.
Mm. Yeah, and the fact that obviously there was a lot of discussion about whether they're called Black or African American, and Elena is trying very hard to do the right thing, but in doing that is actually putting her foot in it. And I think those sort of political and social elements make it something that actually might prompt conversation, and hopefully in this show might take it down a route that we might not be expecting.
That's definitely the most interesting aspect of the show to me. Like the family dynamics, I feel like I've been there, done that before, but the fact that you have these outsiders in this community and highlighting the differences and you know, the weirdness of what it's like to live in an all-white community like that, that's what I'm sort of hooked by at the moment.
So will you be watching the rest of it, Jordan, Matt?
Certainly will.
I will too, yeah.
Me too. And you never know, it might be one of those ones like Big Little Lies that was, the first season was the book and then off it goes and has a life of its own in season two. We'll see. But we can highly recommend that. That's Little Fires Everywhere, which starts on Amazon Prime tomorrow on the 22nd of May. Okay, shall we get our funny on with this caper from Netflix?
Dead.
We know he's dead, but we didn't kill him.
He like tripped a murder or whatever.
We didn't murder anybody.
1, 2, 3, go.
No. Jabron!
Okay, the guy's name is Jabron.
Run, Leilani.
And the girl's name's actually Leilani.
Shit.
She's running too now. Kind of slowly, because she's wearing heels that look actually amazing.
Okay, so this was originally supposed to debut at cinemas. It's been taken on to the small screen by Netflix. Set it up for us, Jordan. Who's in this and what is it about?
Yeah, so this stars Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani. They play a couple who've been dating for about 4 years and smash cut to 4 years later, and their relationship is now sort of on the rocks. And on their way to a party, they have a blazing row in the car and they break up. But then shortly, like literally seconds later, they hit a bicycle courier with their car. And obviously they're shocked by this. And this guy just gets up and cycles away. And then suddenly someone else jumps in their car, claiming to be a cop, and says, "That's a criminal. We've got to chase him down." They chase him down and things don't go as they expect and they're left framed for murder. And then it becomes a kind of madcap caper where across this one long night, they have to kind of prove their innocence and find out what the hell is going on, who these people are, and hopefully salvage their relationship.
Yeah. So what do we think of it? Did you enjoy that madcap caper? For me, it reminded me a bit of Date Night, the Steve Carell and Tina Fey similar premise where they go out on a date and their marriage is failing and then it all goes to hell. This seemed like a
Game Night also had the kind of exact formula where it was kind of couple get involved over their heads in a game and it's sort of, you know, when their relationship's on the rocks.
So the premise isn't particularly original, but is what Kumail and Issa are doing unique? Is that something that's worth watching?
They're both fun performers and there are good moments in this film, but I didn't think either of them or the film itself really did enough. For me, I could absolutely see why this has ended up on Netflix, even outside of, you know, everything going on in the world right now. It just feels much more at home on a streaming service. I think if I'd have seen this in the cinema, I would have thought that's probably not worth my time. But for something you can just press a button and watch on a Friday night, it's not bad. It will pass the time. It doesn't outstay its welcome either. It's, you know, 90 minutes in and out.
87 minutes, actually, isn't it?
87 minutes,
you're
even
better. You're giving it 3 minutes extra. yeah, I mean, what did you think, Matt? Did you enjoy it? It did feel very much like it was a film that had been commissioned by Netflix. It's the sort of thing that they're doing really well, that sort of disposable, easy to watch comedy. Yeah. Did you enjoy it?
I felt largely similar to Jordan. I kind of thought they did have fun chemistry and both of them are sort of charismatic and funny. So that definitely kind of gives it a bit of a lift. But I think if I saw it in a cinema, it would have really lacked a big kind of set piece. Like with those kind of comedies, you expect to walk away being like, oh, there's this one moment that's the kind of, you know, the standout, you know, big belly laugh moment. But I was just kind of smirking throughout, basically, and occasionally, you know, like you do that kind of like when you kind of exhale sharply instead of laughing. I was just doing that a lot, and it just was never really hilarious. And, you know, especially like the kind of the director, Michael Showalter, he did the film, which kind of was Kumail's big screen breakout, The Big Sick. And I thought that was both funnier and more kind of charming and more like, obviously, you really cared about the relationship in that film. Whereas in this one, you know, it feels very frothy, very throwaway I watched it last night and I'm already struggling to remember certain details about it. It was that kind of thing that just left my mind as soon as I kind of, you know, finished watching it.
It felt very like one note, like, hey, why don't you two just bicker? Funny bickering, do funny bickering and do it for the duration of the film. And there are some quite amusing sort of arguments they have, like, you know, do you Google plan an orgy? And, you know, why do cars have cigarette lighters still? And why do they bring you extra milkshake? But it felt very much like they were doing stand-up, little bits of stand-up within this narrative, rather than it really serving any purpose. And at one point, you know, a baddie says to them, you're so annoying. And by that stage, when we were in like the 80th minute, I had to agree because they hadn't taken it anywhere apart from bickering in an amusing fashion.
That was the closest I got to laughing loudly, I think, during the film.
when someone told them they're annoying and pointed a gun at their head.
It's also one of those US comedies where there's a lot of kind of pop culture references that, you know, if you're from outside of the US, you might not necessarily get as well. So again, it just has that vibe to it, and that feels very, very much aimed at an American audience.
And it's set in New Orleans, but you can hardly tell. I don't even know why that was, I mean, presumably for the tax cuts, but I mean, it could have been in any city, just as it could have been anyone in those roles. It feels like something we've seen before numerous times.
Yeah. And for me, if you're going to do like a murder mystery sort of plot, you kind of have to get the mechanics and the nuts and bolts of that right and exciting and interesting. And this just really felt like it was plodding, and they would just find a clue. They would go to the next point, find another clue, go to the next point. There was just nothing interesting or inventive about it. I mean, Matt mentioned Game Night, and that actually worked really well as like a bizarre kind of investigation.
Yeah.
Like even outside the comedy, you're kind of interested in what they're getting up to. But this, I was just like, let's just get to the next backdrop so we can crack some more jokes and then move on to the next place. It just felt like nuts and bolts. They weren't really there.
Yeah, the plots seemed to just serve the scenarios they wanted them to be in. It made actually no sense. I mean, when the reveal of who is the baddie, you're like, but hang on, wouldn't they recognize him? And wouldn't, if they know that, wouldn't they know? It immediately falls to pieces under any sort of scrutiny. And obviously this is another opportunity to see Kumail before he takes his big leading role in The Eternals next year, year after, who knows? Time is elastic now. is this good footing for what he might be doing in that film?
I don't think so. It just feels like him very much in his comfort zone, doing his own sort of normal shtick. And yeah, it doesn't really feel like he's stretching himself at all. You know, again, as Jordan said, it feels like just stand-up performers really just sort of riffing together. It doesn't really give us any sense of his dramatic chops. And obviously, given the kind of shape he's got into, expect it to be a much more kind of physical role than The Eternals, like much more, you know, dynamic in that way. We don't really get any sense of that here.
You do get to see him take his top off. So there's that. If you were interested in that sort of men's health physique, you see a bit of that. And also, let's just mention, there is a very curious torture scene that involves bacon and a horse, which felt like one of those, you know, Cards Against Humanity thing where writers had just put stuff together and that was the outcome. But hey ho. Good fun if you're looking for something that doesn't tax your brain. We would recommend it.
Yeah, just about.
I'd say just about.
In a three-star kind of way.
Okay, so that's The Lovebirds, which is available on Netflix from this Friday, the 22nd of May. Okay, so shall we move from modern hijinks to hooped skirts?
I'm working on a novel. It is a story of my life and my sister's.
Make it short and spicy. And if the main character is a girl, make sure she's married by the end.
Ow, Joe!
So that's Little Women, which is Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's famous American novel about a family of four sisters during the Civil War in America and the loves and deaths and knitting and taking of breakfast to the neighbours and all of the other things that they do during their adolescence and adulthood. What did you think of this? Have you read the book, boys? I mean, I think every woman in the world has probably read this book. Have you guys ever read it?
I've not, no. Most of my Little Women knowledge comes from friends, I'm ashamed to say.
Ah, yes, classic. had you seen other adaptations of this film before you saw it?
Yeah, that's where all my knowledge comes from. I'd seen at least a couple, possibly four or five.
I think I'd seen the Winona Ryder version, but I could barely remember it. So I just literally had those memories of Joey reading it in Friends and the sort of things he says about it. And I rewatched it again for this podcast for the Home Entertainment release. And I must say it kind of really grew on me, you know, on second viewing and first viewing. I liked it with reservations, but I really, really loved it on second viewing. And I really thought it was one of those sort of instant classics on second viewing, and feel like it's going to be just one of those films that's just watched a lot and a lot over the years.
It's another one that was snubbed by Oscar, in as much as there was a lot of discussion that voters hadn't been going to the screenings because it didn't appeal to them, and it didn't get the nominations that perhaps it might have done. Do you think it should have got more awards, Jordan?
Yeah, it's hard to say what. I mean, Greta probably almost certainly should have been nominated for Best Director at least, and she probably should have won for adapted screenplay. As much as I like Jojo Rabbit, I think she probably did a better job, because if you think about the fact that, you know, this is the seventh film adaptation of Little Women, and she managed to find something new and invigorating that none of the other adaptations had really touched on, that's an incredible achievement in terms of adapting a book. So yeah, it almost certainly should have got more recognition.
I can say, I wonder as well if it sort of didn't get in the Oscar race early enough, because for some reason it didn't have really any sort of big festival debut, as far as I remember. Like, it didn't play at any of the big sort of festivals that's kind of launched the awards contenders. So I wonder if that meant it sort of, you know, wasn't out early enough, and so didn't get quite enough people sort of seeing it and buzzing about it early enough, maybe. I don't know, that was just a theory.
So let's talk about the ways in which Greta Gerwig makes this fresh as the umpteenth adaptation. What does she manage to achieve in this that the others haven't?
Well, for me, she just gave it an energy that I just hadn't felt from any of the previous versions. You very much have that Ladybird thing where, you know, you have characters kind of talking over each other, and it's moving at a real clip, a real pace. And the dialogue just feels so fresh and fun, and it feels modern, but it doesn't feel anachronistic for the period either. It's a real kind of tightrope that she's walking in terms of making it feel relevant to today. And she does make it about the struggles that women face, in terms of, in Joe's particular case, getting recognized as a writer. The kind of framing device of this film is her going to this publisher to try and get her stories printed. And at first, she's kind of offered basically nothing for this story, and she kind of accepts it gratefully. But then by the end, you know, she's written her magnum opus, Little Women, and she basically won't compromise. And then she gets a beautiful hardbound copy of her book. So it's about, you know, her growth as a character and her overcoming society that's geared up against her.
Yeah. And it's very much about women and commerce, isn't it? Like, the fact that Gerwig really puts center stage the fact that women cannot earn their own money. And if they do have money, when they marry, it belongs to their husband, and that their children belong to their husband, and that they don't have this ability in this particular time period to be sort of independent. And then it's the ways in which you can do that, and the fact that, you know, can you earn money from writing? And if you can, is that worth more than actually getting the man? I love the fact that in this film, the bookends that you talk about with the sort of the trying to get a book published, ultimately the thing that Jo gets in, the thing that she really wants and that we want to see her get, is that beautiful hardbound book and her work in print. It's not necessarily either of the men, which is Timothy Chalamet and Louis Garrel. Like, it's neither of those guys that we want to see her with. It's that book. And that was a really lovely touch for me. Obviously, the other way that she got quite a bit of flack from people was the fact that she chopped up the narrative, the timeline, and it sort of flips forwards and backwards between the girls as teenagers and their relationship with Laurie, the boy next door, played by Timothy Chalamet, and their sort of fortunes as women when they're either married or trying to get engaged or trying to get published. Did you find that confusing, or could you follow that?
I must admit, maybe it makes me a bit of a dumbass, but the first time I watched it, and again, like I said, someone not particularly familiar with the story, I think that was partly why it was held back a tiny bit for me, and I didn't perhaps love it, because again, maybe I'm just thick, but I found it quite difficult to keep a grasp on it. But this second time, when I had a kind of grounding for the story and kind of, you know, a better grasp of it, it felt very easy to follow. And you've basically just got to follow Florence Pugh's fringe, really, and you know which timeline.
Hair is a good indicator.
But yeah, I must admit, in my first viewing, I think that's why I perhaps didn't love it as much as I did on second viewing. If you've got any kind of grasp on the characters and the story, it's easy enough to follow.
I mean, I could follow it. My main issue was that I didn't really see the purpose of it other than to do something different. I mean, there is one clear scene where I thought it worked beautifully what she was doing with that structure, but other than that, I just thought if you just told this in a straight linear way, it wouldn't be any different. But I've only seen it once, so maybe I need to see it again to properly assess it.
I really liked it because it felt like she juxtaposed their sort of ambition that they had when they were younger with what the reality was and how that had changed or hadn't changed when they were older. So I got quite a lot out of those scenes being put together. There's one scene that is absolutely heartbreaking, not no spoilers, but when you put those two scenes together out of sync, it's just so upsetting. But also the fact that that particular scene comes in the middle of the film, she just gives you a roller coaster ride of emotion rather than it just going to an end point that it does in the book. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed being toyed with and I enjoyed the ride.
Yeah. One of the reasons it possibly didn't work for me was you have, you know, Florence Pugh and Saoirse Ronan and the rest of the cast playing themselves as teenagers and 20-year-olds. And I didn't remotely buy like Florence Pugh as a 13-year-old or however old she's meant to be in the film. Mm. I found that a tiny bit jarring when they're like, oh, you're teenagers. It's like, you don't look like you're 13. You look like you just got out of university.
Yeah, it's a minor quibble, but let's talk about Pugh because she is cracking in this. And I think one of the really refreshing things about this version is that her character, Amy, traditionally has been a really annoying sort of character who you can't really like and who is literally the consolation prize for Laurie, the boy next door. But in this, I felt that Florence Pugh managed to make her really sort of cheeky, likable, a woman we could understand at least, even if you didn't like her. Did you think she was doing some good work there?
Oh yeah, I thought she was great. Yeah, just like she pretty much hasn't put a foot wrong in her career so far, and she was kind of deservedly Oscar nominated for this, I thought as well. Apart from maybe looking a bit too old. To me, that element was forgivable as well, the whole age thing, because you see them playing and putting on these, they put on their own little plays all the time and are always doing that at home. It just kind of added to the kind of sense that this was something that was being sort of played with almost. And again, it's kind of toying with your familiarity in some ways of the book. So I kind of didn't mind that. It almost gave it a sort of a kind of a theatrical quality, but in a sort of good way, I guess.
Yeah, sort of heightened quality to it, maybe. Both Amy and Joe as characters get some really great speeches in this about, a woman's place in the world and how they want to be more than just good for romance, or that if they are choosing to marry a rich man, nobody should criticize them because that is the only avenue open to them. So I thought the sort of writing that Gerwig did around Olcott's original sentiment was really, really good and made it really relevant and made it feel that anyone, man, woman, Civil War era or now, could understand what was going on in those characters' hearts and minds.
Yeah. I mean, to go back to the original point, that's what Greta Gerwig does so beautifully here. Because after Lady Bird, I think everyone was maybe scratching their head a little bit about why she would want to adapt Little Women, a book that's been adapted many times for film before, and why she wouldn't want to continue writing original material. But you can absolutely see why this would be a next step for her, because she clearly had an idea and she executes it wonderfully well.
Mm-hmm. And when we talked to her for the magazine, she said that she had always felt that she was Joe. And as a writer, she strongly identified with her as a character. So again, you can totally see why she might want to take this on. There's also some lovely gentlemen in this film. If you're into, if you're a Chalamaniac, there's plenty to enjoy here. And some lovely Chris Cooper just being delightful as the gentleman next door. I just think everybody's really excellent in this.
Yeah. It just kind of adds to the whole sort of delightful feeling of the film, which again, I found even more so on second viewing, because I was not completely sold on Meryl Streep, for example, the first time, because I almost found it a bit too much. It was like, there's just these kind of great character actors in every role, basically. And I almost found it a bit distracting the first time, but I just kind of really just leaned into it on second viewing and just really enjoyed it. And just at every turn, there's just basically something to enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned Chris Cooper as well. I actually found his casting kind of incredibly disarming, because I think about 2 days before I saw Little Women, I saw A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, where he just plays this absolutely loathsome father figure. And obviously, he typically plays quite loathsome characters, maniacally laughing through the Muppets, for example. And here I was just expecting the same, and you don't. You just get a ton of empathy and warmth from him eventually. And I just found he has some of the most moving moments.
Yes.
I won't spoil one particular scene, but it just reduced me to manly tears.
Was it the scene outside the house with Joe?
No, it wasn't. It was inside the house on a staircase. I won't say anymore.
Oh, I know the one. Yes. Yeah. I watched it a second time for the pod and I thought, oh, it won't affect me. And there were numerous points at which I was wiping my eyes. It grabs you. I just think it's an amazing film. And yeah, I wish it had done better in awards.
And it feels like no one needs to make Little Women again now. We can just end it there. No more film adaptations, please.
Yeah, Greta Gerwig's mic drop moment. It's done. No one else can follow on. Okay, so we're highly recommending Little Women, which is out now on digital and available to buy and keep on DVD and Blu-ray on the 25th of May. Right, so seeing as we have all of these Little Women adaptations that have gone before, are you ready to be quizzed on the people who were part of those films?
God,
I'm ready.
No.
Okay, it's Little Women, Big Questions. Okay, Matt, this is yours. Number one. Laura Dern recently won an Oscar for Marriage Story, but how many times had she been previously nominated? Once, twice, or none?
Probably put my foot in it, but I'm pretty sure she'd won one before, so that's not right, is it? So I'm going to say she was nominated twice before.
Correct, for Rambling Rose and The Wild. Well done. So Jordan, who directed the 1994 version of Little Women? Was it Gillian Armstrong, Jane Campion, or Mimi Leader?
Not entirely sure on this one. I'm pretty sure it's not Jane Campion. And around that time, didn't Mimi Leader make Deep Impact? Which seems like a very different film from Little Women. I'm not familiar with Gillian Armstrong's work, but I guess by process of elimination, it's her?
Correct. Hey. Neck and neck. All right, Matt. In 2008, Greta Gerwig made her directorial debut, or her co-directorial debut with Joe Swanberg. What was the film called, the 2008 film? Was it Days and Nights, Nights and Weekends, or Days and Weekends?
God, this has completely set my mind, but... Can I have those options again, please?
So Days and Nights, Nights and Weekends, or Days and Weekends?
Gonna go Days and Weekends. Is that even an option?
It was wrong. It is Nights and Weekends, so no point for you. Okay, lucky. Jordan, Winona Ryder made her big screen debut in which movie? Beetlejuice, Square Dance, or Lucas?
God, I don't even know what Square Dance is. Hopefully that doesn't make me sound dumb. Was Beetlejuice her first film?
Don't ask me.
I'll go with Beetlejuice because I don't remember her being in anything before that.
Sorry, no, it was Lucas from 1986.
So we're still neck and neck.
Neck and neck. All right, here we go, Matt. Which version of Little Women received the most Oscar nominations? Was it 2019, 1949, or 1933?
I'm going to say 49.
It's actually 2019.
What?
I know. Having discussed how little it got 6 nominations, but not for the ones that we thought were important. Okay, so... Jordan, number 6. Which actor played Mrs. March or Marmy in the 2018 adaptation? Was it Helen Slater, Leah Thompson, or Deborah Winger?
There was a 2018 adaptation? That passed me by. It would have to be a complete guess. Helen Slater is a Supergirl, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Leah Thompson, Back to the Future, obviously. Don't know. Helen Slater.
No, it was Marty McFly's mum, Leah Thompson.
I should have known. The motherly vibe.
Yes.
So we're doing equally appalling so far.
Yeah. Here's another one for you. Who's the odd one out of these? Florence Pugh, Elizabeth Taylor, Katherine Hepburn.
God. This is showing up my lack of watching the other Little Women films. I'm going to say Florence Pugh.
No, it was Katharine Hepburn, because she was Jo and Elizabeth Taylor and Florence Pugh. Yes. Damn. Oh, dear. Honestly. Jordan, please.
This is a really hard quiz.
Let's go. Which of these comedies features a cameo appearance from Susan Sarandon? Zoolander 2, Anchorman 2, Dumb and Dumber 2.
I've seen all of these and I can't remember, but Anchorman 2 and Zoolander 2 are the ones that are full of cameos, so I'm going to assume it's one of those two. Anchorman 2, most of the cameos I remember, like Will Smith and stuff, so I'm going to go Zoolander 2 because I've expunged that film from my memory.
Correct. Very good reasoning. So now you're ahead. We're ready for your final go, Matt.
God, yeah, go on.
All right. Which Harry Potter role did Saoirse Ronan audition for? Was it Hermione Granger, Ginny Weasley, or Luna Lovegood?
Well, what year did Atonement come out? I can't remember where that... Because she would have been very young to audition. I'm just trying to think that Atonement was surely quite a bit after Philosopher's Stone, and she was very young then, so I'm going to say... Luna Lovegood, as that character came in a bit later.
Correct. So two each. Now, Jordan, if you get this, you are the king of the Little Women. Which of these Spielberg movies features a voice-only cameo by Meryl Streep? Is it AI, Artificial Intelligence, Hook, or The Terminal?
Pretty sure I actually know this one for a change. This is AI.
It is AI, you are correct. She is the blue fairy. So that means Jordan Farley is the lovely boy next door, gets to be friends with all the little women. What a treat it is. Okay, so we have come to the end of that. You have proved yourself a total dunce, Matt, so try harder next time. All right, so that's all the time we have for today, but apparently there has been some breaking news. Yes, Jordan, what is that?
Yeah. Breaking news, guys. The Snyder Cut is real. Hashtag release the Snyder Cut.
It's
happening.
Can
you believe this? Apparently, it's coming to HBO Max, which is the new streaming service, presumably only in America, but I guess we'll find out, next year.
Yeah.
The rumors are true. The end of the world is nigh. Can you believe it?
But this does beg the question, like, if you can just reset history, cinematic history, by complaining enough, where does that leave everything? Are we going to have, like, different cuts of everything now?
Yeah, let's get the Aliens 3 David Fincher cut. Let's get Terry Gilliam cut of basically every film he's made. The possibilities are limitless. So, yeah, this is an odd one, isn't it? Because, obviously, fans of Zack Snyder's films have been campaigning for a long time to have his cut of Justice League released after, you know, he was forced to abandon making the film due to a personal tragedy. And then the Justice League that we saw in cinemas was actually finished by Joss Whedon and Warner Brothers. And for a long time, fans of what people believe to be a superior cut of that film have felt there's some version languishing on shelves somewhere which would, you know, rectify all the mistakes that that film makes. That obviously remains to be seen, but I'm quite intrigued. At this point, I just want to know what it is. Like, I'm not entirely convinced it's going to be any better, but...
It would be quite quite cool if it's completely different and he just put... The point of view is completely different and he, you know, everything is different about it. That's quite an intriguing prospect to see that film, considering nobody liked it. very few people liked it. Maybe it's a film that we could grow to love in a different version.
Yeah, the rumor is that they're going to spend an extra 20 to 30 million finishing it.
Wow.
And it could potentially be 4 hours long, which would either mean a 4-hour film or split into multiple parts in a kind of mini series style. Obviously, that's got to be drastically different because I think Justice League is just about 2 hours, if that. That's a hell of a lot of film. That's effectively another film on top of it.
Yeah, and that's a lot of money to spend on something that's essentially a re-edit. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, let's watch this space and see where we get to with that and if we like it more the second time around. And just remember that, as always, there is 10% off total film subscriptions right now with the code INSIDETF, which you write at checkout when you go to www.myfavoritemagazines.co.uk. All right, thank you very much, boys. It was nice to see your lovely faces. What are you doing with the rest of the day? What are you watching?
I think I'm going to go and watch The Magnificent Ambersons. It's actually, I checked it out on iPlayer and it's less than 90 minutes, which basically makes it the perfect film in my eyes.
Yeah, that is great. You can do that over a lunchtime. And Matt, what are you going to be watching?
I'm going to go watch the next episode of Little Fires Everywhere because I've got two more episodes to watch.
Brilliant. I might watch Little Women again just because I love it.
Just right. Why not, yeah.
Why not? It's just so cozy and delightful. All right, we will see you next time. But for now, let's say goodbye. Say goodbye, boys.
Bye.
Bye.
See you next time.